What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus, recording this podcast on a Wednesday afternoon, talking to Danny LaRue of Real GM and the Sporting News. Danny, what's up, man?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm very glad that we're finally able to do this. You hit me up on GChat, I think like a month or 2 months ago, saying that we should do this podcast because it was named after a Sports Night episode, and now we're actually doing it, so it's good times.
Yeah, I mean, Sports Night, when I was growing up, whatever, it was my favorite show, and it's still one of those. I think it was my sophomore year in college, I watched the entire series in like a day.
Oh, so you didn't watch it live?
Oh, no, I did watch it live too. That was my third time seeing it, I believe.
I actually did not watch it live. I discovered it, obviously because I'm a big Aaron Sorkin fan. I discovered it, you know, after I watched The West Wing, all of that when I was in college. My dad, who had given me the DVDs to watch that show, told me that Sorkin had done another show before it, basically about the behind the scenes of ESPN. And I was like, that sounds like a show that was actually just made specifically for me. So I sought it out and started watching it. Basically, I watched the entire thing the week before I started law school. And then nice. It since became one of my favorite shows other than Dana Whitaker. So, but overall, very good show and lent this podcast its name. So very, very happy to find another fan of that show as well.
Absolutely. You want to get on to some happy Pelicans stories?
Yeah, let's start with this tweet that you sent out yesterday about the Pelicans, which I will read it as it was written. It goes, brackets, earmuffs, Pelicans fans, end brackets. I wonder if Anthony Davis regrets not taking his qualifying offer. End of earmuffs. Let's talk about that, because it's something that I have been not necessarily on board with, you know, in terms of Davis taking the qualifying offer, but I've been a very loud critic of the way that they've built their team around Anthony Davis, basically since the moment they made the Jrue Holiday trade. I was very much against that from the start, and then the moves they made subsequently that summer, I was also against. You know, those included sign and trading Robin Lopez and Gravis Vasquez for Tyreek Evans on a 4-year, $44 million deal. And then subsequently after that, they matched Eric Gordon's max contract offer from the Phoenix Suns. Then, you know, because they traded Robin Lopez and traded the draft pick that was the rights to Nerlens Noel, they then later traded another first-round pick for Omer Asik. And then obviously last summer they gave Omer Asik a very big contract and gave his backup, Alexis Ajinsa, however you say his name, a sizable contract as well. They spent $80 million combined on those two guys. Man, have they not necessarily built around Anthony Davis very well.
So there are a lot of different ways of thinking about building teams, but one of the core concepts, especially when you have a guy as good as Anthony Davis, as young as he was, is the idea of surplus value. And so in a league that has a soft cap and that has individual maximum salaries, there are a couple different ways that you can get surplus value. Guys on rookie contracts is a good one. Guys on minimum contracts, guys on max contracts who are better than that. So, you know, like the LeBrons, the Stephen Currys of the world. What New Orleans decided to do with the Jrue Holiday trade and pretty much everything that happened afterwards was to really ignore the idea of surplus value and just go straight into present value. So Jrue Holiday, good basketball player, fits some of the needs that you want, but he was already properly paid, maybe a little bit underpaid, if assuming he was going to stay healthy. And they gave up two lottery picks for him. And so you think about it from that perspective, instead of getting guys who could have grown with Anthony Davis, not only did they give up surplus value because he was close to properly paid, they also gave up a lot of team control, which when you're a smaller market, and we'll talk a little bit, I'm sure, about the Blazers later on, when you're a smaller market, team control really matters. They have team control mattered a whole heck of a lot with Anthony Davis. And so what happens when you don't have that is then those players can leverage you, and that gets into one of the other bad moves they made, which was trading a first-round pick for Omer Asik, who was on an expiring contract, and they didn't have much cap flexibility. So then he bent them over a barrel, and now he has the worst contract in the league.
Right, and you know, not only that, it's not just important for surplus value. it's also important for opportunity costs. You know, they didn't just trade 2 first-round picks for Jrue Holiday. You know, it wasn't just Nerlens Noel and you know, the second pick became Elfrid Payton, but it's also the extra $7 or $8 million in salary cap space that they could have used to lengthen their rotation as well. And that's something that's been an issue for them over the last couple of years, is the back end of their bench. If you had an extra $7 or $8 million to spend, that's, you know, one bench player or maybe two.
Yeah, and there was this weird thing, it was true, I think it was at a point last year where Anthony Davis was their only guy, or maybe it was even earlier this year, he was their only guy on his first NBA contract. Like they had, and when you think about it, that's what time when a lot of guys are underpaid. So if you have to get everybody through the open market, then it's going to be hard, especially when you're not a major, you know, you're not in New York, you're not in LA where you're getting the Wesley Johnsons of the world that are taking the minimum. It's really hard to build a team that way that's good in either the near term or the long term.
Yes, and it's also something that, you know, I think this is important too, and a lot of people discount it sometimes. First round picks are important for, you know, not just the excess value, but to have the low cost certainty when you're going to have guys on maximum contracts on your team. Even if your team is good, you want to be able to have guys that are going to get better while still not being paid a lot of money. And they don't really have anybody like that on their team. You know, that's been an issue with teams like the Knicks trading first-round picks all the time. People are saying, you know, oh, it doesn't matter, they're going to be good in X years, so that first-round pick is going to be bad. It doesn't matter, because when you have high-priced guys on your team, you need to have those low-cost players that provide not just excess value, but low-cost certainty. It's the same thing with the Clippers. You know, yes, Jeff Green will provide more value this year and next year than their 2019 first-round pick will, but now they're also not going to have, you know, another low-paid player that could get better over the course of his contract. Same thing with the Pelicans. They traded their next 3-year first-round picks in a row after drafting Anthony Davis. That's low-cost contracts they didn't have on their team, and they're filling their team out with, like you said, guys that are not providing excess value on their deals, or minimum guys who are actual minimum guys as opposed to guys taking a discount to play, you know, on a good team.
Right, and you also get into the challenge of that a pick is also, you could call it a lottery ticket. You know, there, some of them are going to work out, some of them are not. But, you know, you're not always going to get, and you're almost never going to get a Kawhi Leonard, but sometimes you will. And with a player like Jrue or Tyreke Evans or Omer Asik, they weren't known commodities. You don't really have that upside value with them of them exceeding their expectations because their expectations were pretty much baked in already. And yeah, it's nice to have that kind of certainty, but when you have an amazing player who's young, you want to do that. You want to kind of go in that direction. And that gets into something that is a really important part of team building, in my opinion, which is identifying and working towards a kind of a peak. The term I used back in my old days was the timetable of contention. And the idea is every team is going to be better at some point. It's just the way it works. You can't, unless you're the Spurs, you're always going to peak at some point. And what New Orleans did was they decided to focus on the front end of Anthony Davis's rookie contract when any 19-year-old player, whether he's awesome or bad, is going to be better at 24 than they are at 19. So they could have set up their team so that everybody's kind of cresting at the same time. Instead, they lowered the ceiling and slightly raised the floor and lost flexibility by doing it.
It's sort of similar to the way that Cleveland acted during LeBron's first time around.
Where, it is exactly the same.
Right, where they said, we have to win now to convince him to stay, as opposed to, we have to build a team that can win once he stays, and that will be the reason he stays. Anthony Davis was never going to leave. Like, guys like him always sign that rookie max extension. And the key is you want to be able to be competitive and competing for championships during that second contract so that by the time he comes up for the third contract, during his real prime, he wants to stay.
Stephen Curry's a great example of that.
Absolutely. The perfect example of that.
And so with Davis, the reason, so I wrote a piece for Real GM over the summer advocating for him to take the qualifying offer. And The reason for it, that is not something I support most of the time. He's a rare exception, and that's why I wrote the article. If I supported him more often, I wouldn't take the time to write an article about it. But there were a couple of things that made him different, and the biggest one is that I felt the financial risk was a lot lower. And yes, he is injury-prone, and people have talked about that before, but he is so talented, and his reputation was so sterling in the league, that he could have gotten a max contract anyway. And while it is true that he theoretically would have left the Rose Rule on the table because of the way that they structured it, which is actually kind of a genius, small genius part they put in the extension structure for a guy like him, the cap is rising so quickly that we don't know exactly how much money he actually was leaving on the table to do it the way that he did it. So that was a part of it.
And based on the recent projections, I don't think he actually would have left any money on the table, right?
It would have been pretty small. It's hard to know exactly, but yeah, it wouldn't have been very much. And then the second part, which is the reason why I really wrote the piece, beyond the fact the financial risk, which is important, and practically speaking, that's the reason I would have told him not to do it, but that he was committing to a team that just didn't have it together. And you can talk about the moves they made, but for me, it's not as much about necessarily the decisions you make as much as it is about the process. And what they were doing was they were betting short-term on a team that didn't make sense, and they didn't see themselves in the overall league structure in the right way.
That's the biggest mistake that teams can make, is exactly. Overestimating where they are in their development cycle and saying, you know, we're going for it right now.
And it's the hardest to fix because a lot of times that comes from ownership, and ownership is the one thing that won't change unless they say something racist. So,
right, and I think that that's sort of the specific motivating factor for this team as well. You know, everybody knows Tom Benson is a very old person, and it's been made very clear that he wants the team to be, you know, very competitive right now. And I think that's a big motivating factor in the reason they made, not necessarily all the moves they did, but the reason that their overall plan is what it is.
Yeah, and that's also what makes it really challenging to evaluate general managers. And so a lot of people have killed Dell Demps for various decisions they made. But just like was probably the case with Sam Presti with the James Harden situation, certain times a GM is given a directive and they have to make lemonade. And so you can argue about whether they made the best lemonade they could have made, but that is a very different question from the why did they trade X person or why did they sacrifice, why did they go with this overall philosophy, which is generally above their head.
Right, and I do want to be fair in terms of, you know, Drew, at the time of the trade, I think he was 22 or 23 years old, still very young, still getting better, and is the kind of player that, in theory, should be a very good fit with Anthony Davis. He's a good pick-and-roll player, one of the few guys, you know, at the time of the trade, considered a positive on the defensive end at point guard. You know, most guys are either acceptable or detriments. He was, you know, a guy that was clearly an above-average defender, I think, even at the time of the trade, which was three or four years into his career, I think, at the time. You know, obviously injuries have taken their toll on him. But the other guys, I think, like a guy like Tyreek never made particular sense with Drew, with Gordon, with Austin Rivers, who they still had at the time they made all those moves. You know, never particularly made sense as a guy with Davis because he needs the ball in his hands to be effective, which you already wanted to have the ball in Drew or Davis's hands most of the time. He's not a very good outside shooter. He is theoretically able to guard multiple positions, but in practice not actually able to guard any position all that well, I don't think. And you want to have guys that can either shoot or defend versatilely, if that's a real word. And he didn't fit that. And I don't think that Omer Asik fit that. You know, he's not a threat anywhere on the floor outside of the immediate area of the basket. He's a good rim protector, but not necessarily good on defense anywhere else on the court. And I understand the desire to have, you know, a big bruising guy next to Anthony Davis to save him from the strain of having to play center. But you know, you can do that against certain teams, and then against everyone else that doesn't have those real centers that way, it's perfectly fine to use him there. That's the position he's going to, or at least should, wind up playing anyway, and purposely constructing your team in a way that ensures that he spends most of his time away from that position, I think was a mistake as well.
I agree with all that. I'm really happy you didn't mention the thing that most people do, which is that Drew Holiday was an all-star. That was largely a construct of the conferences at the time. The East, if people remember, was very weak
and that's not to say that he's not a very good player. Like, sure, the player he was at the time made sense.
You know, he's not one of the, he was never one of the six best point guards in the league. It's just that he was one of the three best point guards in the East at that time.
Right, absolutely.
And so the other big part of it, I think you nailed a lot of the major strokes, but one other one that I think is an important part of this is they had Omer Asik last year. It didn't work out particularly well. He did some things well, certain other things were flawed. So when that happens, a good management, good ownership, let's say a front office will go, okay, that means that we can kind of take it or leave it with this guy. You know, if we can use that money another way, we can maybe it was him specifically, maybe it was that. If he wants to take a contract that we think is a good value, sure. If he wants to take a contract that is too rich for us, then we'll let him go. And that is not the way they approached his free agency, because you do not get to the worst contract that way. You get there by saying, we have to keep this guy, and that was not the right mentality, especially when it didn't work.
And especially when they're paying his backup $20 million over 4 years as well.
Yeah, and as your frequent podcast partner Seth Parno brought up when he and I were talking about this back in July, is the issue with Ajinsa was not as much the dollars as much as it was the years. And you don't commit that kind of long-term thing to a guy if it's not a really good value. You know, if you're signing a guy to the Hinkie special, where it's basically at the minimum or near the minimum, like for Kendall Marshall, yeah, you know, that's not a big risk. But when you're doing it for $5 million a year, that's not going to be a ton in the new CBA, but it's definitely something. And one of the ways that I did an AMA on Reddit yesterday, and one of the things a lot of people asked me was, what should my team do? And one of the easiest things to think about that is also generic enough that you can use it is, you never want to sign somebody to a contract that 12 months later will be difficult to move, because that means either the player's not good enough, the contract's not good enough, or both. And the Pelicans have done that a few times over recently, and the time that you do that, if you have to, is when your team is so good that you have to keep it together. You know, like, if Iguodala was a free agent this year, or if Bogut was a free agent this year, you know, maybe you think about things a little bit differently. Miami, when they had all their great players. New Orleans wasn't there. New Orleans isn't there. And so you can't think that way until you get that point, because that money doesn't come off. If it's not tradable, it stays. It stays there forever. And as somebody for you who's more closely connected with the New York teams, they can speak to that better than anyone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they that's basically their team-building philosophy, is to just pay anybody whatever they want. And I think all of this plays into the fact that New Orleans, I think they should have just gotten whatever they could for the two expiring guys that they have on big deals right now, Gordon and Ryan Anderson. Gordon, I think it's fairly clear he's not going to be back. Ryan Anderson, supposedly they want to bring back, which to me is just crazy. Like, they're paying Anthony Davis well over $100 million over the next 5 years. Asik is on a big contract. Ajinsa, they just gave a contract. Now they're going to pay another big man big money? Like, it's insane.
Even at a discount, I don't think I'd want Ryan Anderson on the Pelicans long term. You know, if we're thinking about the way I like to phrase this, is the next great Pelicans team. He's, he'll turn 29 during this summer. And of course, it seems like he's a really good guy. His story, if you haven't read the Chris Mannix piece, is incredible. I've known him anecdotally a little bit. Wonderful guy. It's no, in no way a criticism of that. I like him as a basketball player, too. But he doesn't fit with what they had, and his kind of age curve really doesn't fit with it. So if you have a guy who is clearly a good basketball player, but who you shouldn't sign to his next contract, and your team, his present value for your specific team is in a way kind of negative because he's good enough to hurt your draft pick, that's an easy guy to trade. And yeah, it can hurt your optics that, you know, that you trade a guy who seems like he really likes the city and who makes your team better. But you know what? Short-term optics don't win you anything. And he would have, in a way, I think you'd be doing him a favor, too. If they had traded him to Toronto, let's say, like, he gets to play on a team that's going to be dangerous, that's going to go in. I think it helps his market value. And, like, let's say with Eric Gordon, like, he's going to get playing time because Tyreek is out. But it's playing time on a team that's really far out of it, that's depressing and all that kind of thing. And so I think that trading somebody like that for the best offer you can get, whatever your priority is, is doing the best by everyone. And your fan base, they're so dead right now for this year that it doesn't matter if they're a little bit worse because they're already depressing and terrible.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with all of that. And I think part of it is that they still think they're in the playoff race for some reason, when that is just not at all the case. You know, I think they were 6.5 games out, somewhere around there, when the trade deadline came around. And, you know, with Tyreek out for the year, and with Quincy Pondexter out for the year, and everybody else on their team in and out of the lineup with injuries, there comes a time where you just have to recognize where you are, not only in your development cycle, but in the context of the league that year, and admit that you're done. And when you're sick, when you're as close to the third worst record in the league as you are to the playoffs, which, you know, I wrote in a piece on Vice Sports advocating that they should basically do what we just talked about, get whatever they can for guys like Anderson and Gordon. Like, that's the case. Like, you're done when you're that close to the third worst record in the league. That's, you just got to suck it up and admit it, as painful as it is.
Yeah, and what they did, the only way you would ever see that is that it isn't true is if kind of the playoff race was worse than you expected, which is partially true this year, but it's strengthening up, and where you think that what you did is so non-reflective that it's more likely than not that you can make it in.
Right. And
and that's just not, that wasn't a realistic interpretation of where they were. And we saw that when they got shellacked last night by the Wizards. Like, this is a team that isn't as terrible as they were at the start of the year. I mean, that was non-representative, but also one of the things that was the reason for that is they were saddled by injuries, and guess what? They knew Tyreek Evans was out for the year. We all knew it. So that is a part of their expectation. Part of their expectation is that they were going to be without one of their best players for this year. And if you want to do it, a kind of a sad but short game with them is, what player on this team would you consider a net asset moving forward? So let's exclude this year entirely. So we don't count Ryan Anderson. We don't count Eric Gordon.
There's only one. That's it. It's Davis. That's it.
Well, I would say if I could theoretically take Drew Holiday for, you know, at about $11 million for next year, I would do that.
Oh,
but
just
I wouldn't give up much for him.
Well, and that's also, he's only under contract for next year.
Yeah, and then he's an unrestricted free agent. So
right,
not,
coming into a $108 million cap at, I think he'll be 27 or 28 next offseason.
He'll be at the 25% max, but or I mean the 30% max, but he won't get it. But
right.
Yeah, he'll have had that. And if we've seen one thing from, you and I have of course spent way too long obsessing about this upcoming free agent class, there are no point guards.
Nope.
So every point guard, especially one that you can talk yourself into, is going to get overpaid. So you're in a tough spot. So yeah, I would consider him an asset. I wouldn't consider Drew a great asset. Like in the mock off mock deadline one, I think he'd be a really fun fit on the Jazz. I think that would be, but I wouldn't like give up a great asset for him. I don't think I'd give up their own first round pick. So,
no, I don't think I would either.
Yeah, and like Pondexter, I like his contract, but he hasn't been able to be on the floor this year. So like right now, I'm not sure that I would trade much for him. I consider him a slight asset. And other than those two, and of course Anthony Davis, I think that it's not unless you had so little cap flexibility that Ajinsa is better than who you can get. But look at the league; everybody has cap flexibility.
Right. And all that talk, though, about recognizing where you are in your development cycle, I think actually makes a nice transition to our next topic, which is the Blazers, who have surprisingly not necessarily sped up their development cycle, but just sort of skipped over the part where they're really bad, which I think everybody thought was going to be the case this year. You know, they lost 4/5 of their starting lineup. And obviously Damian Lillard came back, and he's just an unbelievable player. He's on absolute freaking fire lately. CJ McCollum has stepped up. Alan Crabb went from not playing at all last year to being an important part of their rotation. But they made a lot of moves over the summer. And then Myers Leonard also went from being a fringe rotation player to an important rotation player. But they made a bunch of moves over the summer that they targeted guys in the age range of Lillard and McCollum that could grow with them and be part of the next good team. Sort of the opposite, I think, of what the Pelicans did. You know, Mo Harkless, Noah Vonleh, Mason Plumlee, Ed Davis, and Al-Farouq Aminu. Those five guys are all playing important roles on the Blazers. They're all, I think Davis is the oldest one, and he is,
I think he's 25. Might be 26.
25, 26. But right there, that's how you build around your star player. Like, it's everybody is growing together, and the skill sets those guys have, you know, they're all very good athletes, get up and down the floor, fits very well with what Lillard and McCollum want to do. They have pick and roll and pick and pop big men in Plumlee, Leonard, and Vonleh. Crabb is a good and Davis as well. Crabb is a good shooter. Al-Farouq Aminu can actually guard multiple positions, has stretched himself out over the last few years as a shooter as well, shooting 35% from three. I mean, it's a team that makes sense, and that's why they're playing better than people expected, I think, you know, just in my mind at least.
Yeah, so they had two big successes at the same time. So you talked about one, which is the idea that they, you know, got guys who made sense. And the second part, which is, I would say, no less or more important than the first part, is what we had just talked about with the Pelicans of no bad contracts is what they did. So if we play the same game that we just did with the Pelicans, and you say, okay, fast forward to July 15th, 2016, who on their team is a positive and who's a negative? Every single guy, excluding Anderson Varejao, who they waived and all that, unless you have a really low opinion on one of their young guys, and they're almost all on non-guaranteed contracts, everybody's a positive. So if it didn't work out, assuming it wasn't like you horribly misevaluated them, you could move them if it didn't work. You know, if Noah Vonleh played so well that you didn't need Ed Davis anymore, big whoop, somebody will want him. You're not in a situation where you're going to have to give up assets for that. And that's a great way to do it. And you brought up a point with them, which I think is incredibly important, is the idea that they got a lot of these guys through free agency. The only asset beyond their own cap space, and they were still, of course, a team that was able to get a first-round pick because of their extra cap space. The only asset they gave up was the pick that became Rondae Hollis-Jefferson in a trade that I personally wouldn't have made, but that's because of my love for Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. And they did it to get a guy who's still a value. Mason Plumlee has this year where he's cheap, next year where he's cheap. And, you know, he's a useful player. He's been a big part of their success. So even though I slightly disagreed with that, it wasn't bad. You know, it wasn't a horrible deal. It was just something that I had a personal disagreement with. And so when you can hit that often, it's very important. And one other point for people who listen to this who are kind of, you know, in the same mindset as the two of us and CBA stuff is a general rule that you see, which is this. If a player signs on the first day of free agency and they are not getting their maximum, odds are they probably could have gotten more. Al-Farouq Aminu is one of those guys. I think Ed Davis was a couple days later, but it's the same general idea. Damari Carroll, he got one of the better value contracts. I think Biombo was somewhat early. Like, you get into those situations because teams are going to be spending money like crazy people last year, especially this year, and a little bit next year. And so when you can, they didn't waste their time going after the, you know, the big fish that weren't really going to be that interested, or even if maybe they did both of those things at the same time better than other teams did, they targeted players who made sense at their price. They went after them. They gave them a fair market value, a deal that they would not shop around, but that they were happy with. And that's, when you're a smaller or mid-market team, that is the best that you can do.
And I think it's also important to note that, you know, unlike the Pelicans, the Blazers have had a bunch of picks. You know, obviously it was in the context of a much different team, you know, that was built around Aldridge and Matthews and Batum and Robin Lopez. But, you know, after they picked Damian Lillard, you know, in the same draft they got Myers Leonard. They drafted CJ McCollum. They I believe traded for Allen Crabbe on draft day. All four of those guys have worked out. You know, that doesn't happen every single time, but like you said earlier, it's a lottery shot, and they happen to hit on all of them being at least quality rotation players.
And CJ McCollum is definitely the biggest payout of those guys, just because, especially recently, like that, what he provides is so hard to find. But that happens, you know. He was a talented dude. And they gave him the time to develop, and they gave him the kind of the rope, and they didn't think about if CJ had been drafted by, let's say, the Sacramento Kings. I don't know what he would be right now. You know, maybe he'd be the same. You know, you can't say definitively that it would have been, but he was put in a nice situation to really take the time. And also, what he does is incredibly useful. Shot creation at a position other than point guard, creating for himself and for others, is something that teams will always pay for. It's why New Orleans overpaid for Tyreek. It was a mistake, but that's why they did it. And to be able to have that from a guy that you picked, you know, not super high, is fantastic.
I think he was like the 9th pick in the draft, though, wasn't he?
That sounds about right. I'm honestly not sure where. He was a guy who was funny. Like, I was fighting for him so hard when he was originally lower on people's boards that I always think of him down there, but he might have been drafted higher. I honestly can't remember.
The 10th pick in the 2013 draft.
And that draft was terrible. So, 2013 was the Gobert-Giannis draft, right?
2013 was, yeah, it was
Nerlens Noel,
Anthony Bennett, Oladipo, Porter, Cody Zeller, Alex Len, Noel, McLemore, KCP, Trey Burke, and then McCollum.
Yeah.
One pick before MCW.
For anybody who wants to have fun, you can go back and read my draft board from that night. I was right for a very weird reason. We can talk about it if you want.
Sure, go ahead.
So, that was like one of the last drafts where I really knew the prospects well. And because now I've watched so much NBA that I just don't have enough time to watch much. And I had this operating theory with that class, and it was that everybody had a really low floor. I just every guy in that class, and we've actually seen that pretty well, just a lot of guys had low floors. And so what my thought process was, okay, if everybody has a low floor, then let's focus on ceilings. Because that's what, you know, that's upside, and, you know, if you, obviously, outcomes are not, you know, it's not like they're narrowly located towards the ceiling or the floor or anything like that, but that was the idea. So I had Rudy Gobert 3rd. I had Giannis in the top. I think I had Giannis 7th. And the idea was basically that if you're going to bet, why not aim high? And the teams that did that, you know, not all of them won, but most of them did. And the teams that went for a more sure thing overall lost out.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and that's not true in most drafts. Like, the way that I did that, that wasn't true in 2012. That wasn't true in 2011. It was just happened that that group, I mean, you can, Nerlens Noel is probably the best example of that. Like, Nerlens Noel, I had him clear-cut number one because I thought he had the highest floor. And Oladipo was interesting, but other than those guys, like, Deion Waiters, I saw a lot of disaster potential with him, and we're seeing it now. That isn't to say that he can't work, but I just saw that, the worst and near-worst case scenarios with him scared me. On a good team.
The balance between best case scenario, worst case scenario, and most likely scenario is always interesting to watch, you know, the way people build their draft boards. For me, and this is something that I discussed you know, a whole lot with people in the lead up to last year's drafts, obviously, because I'm a Knicks fan, and there was, you know, they had the 4th pick, their highest pick, I think, since, like, I don't know, maybe even their highest since Ewing, because I think that the highest pick after that was 5. I like to go for the most likely scenario. And that was why I wanted, like, Justice Winslow or Cauley Stein were, like, the top guys on my board, since I knew, or not knew, but I thought with great certainty that Towns, Okafor, and Russell would be off the board. And I was like, the most likely case scenario for those guys is that they're going to be considerably above average defensive players and at least contributors on offense because of the way their skill sets are. And that was why I thought those guys, no matter what, you're getting an above average rotation player. Obviously, Phil Jackson saw things differently and was like, I'm going to take the guy that I think can be the best player in the draft. And that has worked out extremely well. That's not to say that Winslow or Cauley Stein or Miles Turner or any number of other guys wouldn't have been good picks, but obviously he saw, you know, the balance of the board differently than I did, and that informs who gets picked.
It does, and I'm really pissed at Sevilla for not showcasing his passing ability, because I didn't see a ton of him, but I saw enough to kind of have an informed opinion. And the thing that concerned me was I said this on Dunked On once, was I didn't see the connective tissue. And, you know, the passing and some of the rebounding, his offensive rebounding was always good, but, you know, some of that kind of stuff. And what happened is, it turned out he had it. I just hadn't seen it yet, and a lot of that is because his team hadn't afforded him the opportunity. They were asking him to do something different. And that happens. You know, that isn't my fault, that isn't anybody, that does happen sometimes, but this class was interesting because so many guys are doing really well. I would have wanted the Knicks to take Moutier with the full knowledge that he would have been bad this year, just with the idea that what he provides is so important, and I think he's going to do it, and I'm still high on him. I think Porzingis is closer to reaching Porzingis' ceiling is crazy high, and he's closer to reaching it than I ever thought he would be at this point. But, you know, and that's wonderful, and it's a great success story.
Yeah.
But there are lots of different ways that you can do it, and there are a few wrong ways, but there are also a lot of right ways.
Yes, definitely. And I do want to make clear, just for the Knicks people, I'm sure, that are listening, that Porzingis was one of the guys on my annual guys I like list, not on the guys I don't like list, which I tweet out every year after the Knicks make their pick, and usually it's a guy that I don't like that they took, like when they took Tim Hardaway Jr. Anyway.
How did they get a first-round pick for him?
It makes no sense. It's Warlock shit.
They got a first-round pick for him that was better than the pick Brooklyn got for Mason Plumlee.
Right. Hardaway was the 24th pick in a bad draft, wasn't good for 2 years, and they traded him for the 19th pick in what has turned out to be an incredible draft. It makes no sense.
When the story is written eventually about the Hawks, that will be a part of it. As you know, that was a really poor use of an asset for them. And as we're seeing, they're still good, of course, and Budenholzer is a wonderful coach. But you need to hit, when you're not the Knicks, when you're not the Lakers, you need to hit on almost everything to be a real contender. You know, if you want to just make the playoffs every year, you can do that. If you have the right talent, if you have a Damian Lillard, if you have a Stephen Curry, you can be at that level as long as you keep a requisite amount of talent like what the Blazers have. But if you want to be more than that, like what the Hawks were last year, you can't miss very often. And that was the first real one where you're sitting there going, oh, this might be a problem.
Yes, and I think it was very obvious right on draft night.
What you worry about with a guy like Tim Hardaway is when the people who know him best, like people who've watched him a lot and all that, say, wow, that makes no sense. You always have to wonder, you're saying, oh, what did they see in him that these people didn't? And the answer appears to be, we don't know.
Yeah. I don't have much more to say about Tim Hardaway. I do want to, because I have to get out in a few minutes here, I want to go quickly to the recent backlash to Steph Curry's quote-unquote cockiness. There were a couple pieces today, one by Bethlehem Scholes, one by someone at Vice, I can't remember off the top of my head who wrote it, just sort of about Steph's showmanship, which to me is like one of the most fun parts of the Warriors, the idea that they know that they're putting on a show and they embrace that. I know that you live in the Bay Area, go to Warriors games all the time. I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are on that specific issue and how the Warriors deal with it, how other teams have reacted to it, how, you know, media people are starting to react to it. What are your thoughts on that?
Broadly speaking, I really enjoy showmanship that is not taunting. Like, I will say uniformly that I love that. So end zone dances, things like that. If you've done something good, unless your team is behind by a lot, and then it's just cheesy. But other than that, I'm completely good with it. I see things that are more specific taunting a little bit different, where it's like if you're pointing in a guy's face, like when Sean Kemp dunked on, was that Gatling?
I don't remember who exactly it was.
How am I not remembering? This is really killing my Bay Area fan cred, even though it was against the Warriors. Anyway, but you guys get what I'm talking about. Like, that sort of thing I don't love as much, and that is really what the most recent Curry shimmy was about. I don't particularly love that, but I also am completely fine with guys doing it, because what a team can do if they don't want to have that happen is just stop him.
Right.
Like, you can... He's not going to shimmy when he doesn't make a shot, whether that be that he doesn't take it or it doesn't go in.
Also, didn't we love Antoine Walker specifically for that reason? Because he would make a ridiculous shot and then shimmy? But now that's like the best player in the league doing that, people don't like it? It makes no sense.
Yeah, I really don't. I'm not a big fan of that kind of thing. And I don't think that it... The part of the reason why I don't love taunting in particular is I do think that's the type of thing that can set a bad example. Like, if you get in the end zone, you should celebrate. If you make a three-pointer, you should. But, yeah, I don't like making the other guy look bad. But at the same point, it's not that big a deal.
It's not a big deal at all.
And I think that the idea that the Warriors have embraced their showmanship is kind of a fun wrinkle to this. And it really has happened, to my eye, it has happened somewhat organically. I mean, Curry's always had a little bit of swagger, more in the game itself than outside of that, but he has become a spectacle. This is a situation, that same game in Atlanta, I think they did it under other auspices, like the weather was bad. They opened the arena early so fans could watch him warm up. Like, the rules of fandom are different right now with this Warriors team, so those who expect them to not see that as people who have been in the league a long time would be just crazy.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's very much like the Jordan Bulls, where when they came to town, it was a show before it was a game. And
exactly. And
when,
so
when you're 50-5, like, it's a show. I've said it multiple times this season. They are the best show on TV right now. And with the era of peak TV we're in, that's fucking crazy.
It is. And I think that also one of the aspects of this that I think people sometimes lose sight of is the NBA season is really long. And sometimes things like that help keep you engaged, keep you into it. And the Warriors are going after a piece of history, and you can say, oh, that should be enough to motivate them. But, you know, playing that game was their third game in four nights. They had traveled cross-country. That was their day off, quote-unquote, was traveling cross-country to go to Atlanta, having played in L.A. the night before. And then they had a day off, and then they play Miami on Wednesday, and then they play Orlando on Thursday. So... you kind of need things like that. You know, people talk about it with baseball, which is funny because most of baseball is standing around. But playing basketball that many times in a row, I think it's a little bit of a physical grind, but I think it's mostly a mental one. So what can give you an edge, what makes the sport fun, if that's showboating for you, that's great, because that's something that can make each game a little bit more doable, especially when the Warriors right now, other than history, they aren't playing for a whole lot because the Spurs are far enough back that I don't think they're really stressing about the number one seed in a very game-by-game sense at this point. You know, maybe if April 1st hits and it's still close, they'll think about it.
Right. I'm in complete agreement with all of that. I mean, and even, look, the Spurs are 3.5 games back of them right now. You know, they've lost 5 games all year, and you know, they're San Antonio is 4 games back in the loss column. They'd have to almost double their losses to...
Well, if the Warriors are going to make history, the Spurs can only lose, I think, once more the rest of the season.
Right. And so that would be, you know, to tie the record.
Yeah, and the Spurs are going to, they're going to lose a few games because they don't prioritize that at me. Nate Duncan, my frequent podcast partner, asked Popovich point blank. I think he asked both coaches the same night, and Kerr was much more definitive that the number one seed mattered, and Popovich said rest is most important. So you should expect them to be more judicious with the rest than the Warriors, because the coaches said it, and they're the ones who make the decisions.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's true to the philosophy, I think, of both teams.
Yeah, and the Spurs are older. You know, if Stephen Curry was 35, I think Steve Kerr would value that more, but he's 27 or 28. I think he's 28 now. So you can play them a little bit looser. And he said more what Kerr said, which I think is a fair point, is that having the number one seed is a pretty notable advantage. And so I don't think it was like, oh, we're going to play my guys 38 minutes a night to get there. But it's like if it's a tie, that's a pretty strong tiebreaker, I think, the way he was thinking about it.
Especially when you play where Golden State does. They're undefeated at home. They have one of the best home court advantages in the league. It's important for them to get it. It's important for them to win it as much as they can so they can ensure that the Spurs don't catch them.
Yeah, and they never even needed it in last year's playoffs, but I'm sure they appreciated having that in their back pocket.
Absolutely, and I would imagine they'll appreciate it again this year, you know, given, look, you know, they're on a historic pace, maybe the best team ever by the time it's all said and done, but San Antonio is really freaking good too. Oklahoma City is really good. The Clippers are really good, even without Blake Griffin right now. You want to have that last game at home against those teams.
Absolutely, and you want to have the benefit of ideally playing weaker teams in the earlier rounds. Like, the benefit of getting the number one seed is, in this specific Western Conference, is not only getting the home court advantage in a Game 7 at Oracle, it's that the number two and number three teams are both awfully good, and they're going to have to face each other before they face you.
Exactly. Anyway, if that's all you got on that particular subject, that seems like a good place to wrap things up here.
Sure.
Excellent. Danny, thank you so much for coming on. Do you want to let the people know where they can find your work and your Twitter stylings and anything else?
Sure. So I write for Real GM, The Sporting News, and Warriors World, and periodically other places. Twitter, it's Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux. And Danny LaRue NBA is my Facebook page where I try to combine everything. And really, there's no fluff there. And so I just put everything there if you want to just see what I do.
Excellent. Of course, I am on Twitter at JADubin5. You can find this podcast and all of the other HP Basketball Network podcasts at hardwoodparoxysm.com. If you click on the link at the top of the page that says Podcast Center, you'll find them there. You can also find them on iTunes by searching for HP Basketball Network, or you can search for the name of this podcast, which, again, as we stated right at the start, is Quo Vadimus. Danny, thanks again, man. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely a pleasure, man.